Folks, last week you asked that we talk a bit more about the context of our ministry as a beginning point to help set the context for the work that we're doing. And so we thought that tonight what we'd do is to talk about the kind of struggles that we've had and how we've come to using these methods that we'll be presenting to you, as well as other methods of prayer and contemplation and worship. And I'd like to begin by saying that I call myself an experimental theologian, and that I'm really concerned about starting an experience and then reflecting on experience in community. So a lot of what we're doing is experimental, it is new, and we're still struggling to find words for some of what we say. So if we say something that's a little clumsy or whatever, please understand that we're in process. This is not a presentation that we travel around the country giving. This is not the 42nd time we've done this, and this is something that's in process for us. And so what we'll do tonight is to talk a bit about kind of what we're doing and what our goals have been, and then also then during the next 3 nights we'll look at three different approaches to prayer and contemplation. Tomorrow, look at centering prayer. The next day, look at chanted prayer, and then on Wednesday, look at kaithing, and then on Friday, look at how some of these practices spill over into everyday life. People talk about is praying without ceasing. And in some ways that we might look at what that means. Basically, we're very busy folks, struggling in difficult ministries. And what we've attempted to do is to find practical means of spirituality that will allow us to open ourselves to the presence of God and to the movement of the Spirit, and to be about what we're doing. I work as a minister of urban mission at the United Church of Christ Church, an ordained United Church of Christ minister, and work primarily with chronically mentally ill homeless people and other people who have long-term physical disabilities who ended up, for whatever reason, very marginalized, and many folks living on the streets or close to it. As many of you know, our medical care system is such that if you're chronically ill, it's a way of really eroding a lot of support systems in a hurry. It's a very difficult kind of process for folks. We work in one of the most diverse neighborhoods in Chicago. There are over 60 languages spoken in the high school near where we lived until a few weeks ago. Please come in. It's a point of
entry. Chairs in front.
It's a point of entry for new immigrants. It's also it's incredibly economically diverse. There are people who are living in $1,500 a month townhouses, and there are people who are living on the streets in front of the church. We have a shelter in our church. We have a community dinner program. We do other kinds of things. But the work that I'm engaged in is on the streets, now in the SROs, the single room occupancy hotels. What I found very early on was that it was necessary for me to be about a certain kind of practice of opening in order to be with folks who are on the streets and in these other places, in order to keep from just being overwhelmed by the struggles that people are in. And so some of the things that we'll talk about, some of the methods have been helpful to us, and we've incorporated some of them into the worship that we're engaged in. I want to talk a bit about the pacing of this kind of work. I wear a clerical collar while I'm on the streets. I first started working with some of my ministry people who encouraged us to do that. And there are pros and cons to wearing a clerical collar. I worked in some very dangerous areas. There were about 10 people killed within 3 blocks of our church last summer. Because there's a lot of drug dealing going on. I'd like to believe that wearing a clerical collar might give me some edge. I figure, A, people figure out how many money.
Right.
B, they figure that, for the folks who have any segment, any remnants of belief, they might get in trouble. Please come in, sit down, please.
Can we steal a couple of your chairs from the other room?
It's not good marketing to do that, basically.
You want to do it?
I know, we'll come back again, someone's coming back.
Yeah, I wish we were going to be at Kilimanjaro, actually, I talked to John about it, we're trying to talk with each other about things, we're both, we have some similar cross interests. And I think the third part of it has to do with the fact that they figured they might get more heat if they, from the police, if they hassle them. But there are other kind of trade-offs too, because I talk about it, I'm trained as a clinical psychologist and as an experimental psychologist, as well as being a UCC minister, and what I'm aware of is a lot of, is I talk about being a walking Rorschach ink blot test, where it means that people kind of project onto me their feelings about the church. And I can tell you a lot of street people aren't real amused. Okay? A lot of street people have been really, really feel abandoned by the church. A lot of denominations left the city in the 50s and 60s, and a lot of the people who stay on the streets are people who are fairly heavy-handed. And so part of what the expectation is when people see me on the street, is I'm going to lay a track on them, and I'm going to come across in a certain kind of way. Well, I don't do that. And so what happens is people's expectations are shattered, and then we move ahead into some other kind of conversation. But the pacing of this has been very difficult. The first 6 months I was on the streets, people thought I was a narc, which is not a particularly good reputation to have. Because basically the operating, the way people operate in the streets is that if everybody has an agenda, okay, if I don't have a clear-cut agenda, or if I don't meet the expectations of the usual street minister, that somebody is going to pass out tracts, I must have another agenda, and it ain't good. And so they figured that must be a narc. And so I was just informing for the police. This was not a reputation that I particularly wanted to foster, because it's pretty dangerous. And eventually people began to recast who I was, and they realized I was who I am. And I, what you see is what you get, for better or worse. And so one guy asked me in the street one day, he says, do you used to ride bikes? I said, I used to ride bikes. Oh, I was a bummer. You know, and I didn't tell him I rode a BMW. I would ruin the image. But that was a Harley, so I chose not to say anything. And then people started calling me George the Hooligan Priest. And most people call me Father George now. I've told hundreds of people that I'm a Protestant minister, but if you wear a clerical collar, you're your father, and that's, you know, that's fine. So it's a little embarrassing when my other colleagues from UCC come around and walk around with me on the streets. These folks are calling me Father George, but so it goes. And after a time of being with folks on the streets, I was invited into some of the drop-in centers, and which are places where folks who are homeless can get off the streets during the day when the shelters are closed and do rap groups. And again, that was an eye-opening experience, because again, being trained as you know in clinical psychology, you know, we want to kind of express, you know, encourage people to kind of express where they're at, and to break down barriers and to be more open and these kind of things. And what people told me very wisely, very quickly was, you know, it's okay for us to do this in here, but if I do this out in the street, I become prey. People would regard it as vulnerability, and you can't be vulnerable on the street. You can't do that. And so part of the walk that I've been called to walk on the streets is not to be prey, but also not to harden my heart so much that I don't see beyond the surface of what's going on with folks. And that's part of the practice that we'll talk about throughout this week, I think, is a practice of being in a dance with folks where we can be open to the other person, but not be manipulated. And one of the people I know who's written so well about this is Walter Wink, who talks about Jesus' third way, about not being a doormat, as not being passive, not being aggressive, but engaging in transformative ways as best we can. And that's a very interesting dance in a situation like where we work, because the pain and the brokenness is so overwhelming, we cannot possibly meet people's needs as they're stated. And so many people have learned to survive on the streets, but they develop so many cons. I mean, I've heard every possible rationale for why someone needs money. And I've heard, and so part of what I've had to learn how to do to be with people is to kind of get beyond that point and figure out what's going on. But it's very difficult, because my first response, as it may be for many of you, is just to shut down. You know, it's like, and that's what I think we're called not to do, is not to shut down, not to close our hearts, but to open our hearts. Now, and what's happened as all along the way Nancy and I were moving into this ministry, she can talk about some of the work that Nancy's doing in ministry too. I should mention that we both belong to a covenantal Christian community called Shalom Ministries, which was founded by a French Huguenot Presbyterian minister, Claude Bardoir, about 15 years ago. And it's a community of about 80 people who live all over the world. And we're covenant together to engage in cross-cultural mission in certain kinds of ways. And the ways we agreed to enter into mission are to work with the poor, to contextualize what we do, that is, to have what we do try to fit in with where people are at, to be bridge builders, that is, to insert ourselves in between systems, to be in a dance of always moving, always being in betweenness. So a lot of our work is not only to be with the poor, but to try to encourage middle-class folks such as ourselves and other people to become friends of the poor. So these are, and then the final theological principle that we all adhere to is called mission in reverse. And now we'll talk about that in detail on Thursday as part of this tithing, notion of tithing. But it means basically encouraging the other person in very deep ways to be our teacher. And it's very difficult for those of for me, I think for many other people who are overeducated, to surrender my agendas to the other and to have the other person truly share what they understand. And let me tell you, my friends, the poor who live amongst us have got great wisdom that to share with us that I wish were permeating up more into our culture than what we're seeing. There's a great deal of wisdom there, and many gifts that are given. So Nancy and I belong to this group, Shalom Ministries, which has been a very powerful place where it's a worshiping community, it's a community of support and accountability. We meet once or twice a month and we worship together and we share our stories about what we're doing together. And it's about half Roman Catholic, half Protestant. There are many people of color who are members of the community, many people who are Native American, African, Asian, folks who've been touched by this kind of process of mission. And so what we do is we all engage in some kind of cross-cultural mission work, and those of us who live in Chicago who are part of this core group of the community also engage in training missionaries. And we're putting together a book, we hope, within the next year that'll be called Mission in Reverse, Listening to Voices from the Margins, that will be a series of stories by people, primarily by people who have been people who have been very much hurt by the old style of mission, who will talk about how the fact that their, for instance, the Lakota people, where their ceremonies were denied them until 1978. And how broken that caused the community, but now how people are finding out in the church how some of the cultural portions of the traditional culture can in fact be very richly celebrated within the church. And these are all ministers or priests or Catholic sisters who are native people of various sorts who are going to tell their story about how they kind of came through that process and now are about doing mission in another way. And so we're really trying to figure out how to be with people in ways that encourages folks to provide one another with the gifts that their culture and they as individuals have. And again, my particular work is primarily with the poor, with poor people in Chicago. And so my primary work is to cross over that boundary of culture, oftentimes of race, oftentimes of other kind of culture, to be with people and to set aside my preconceived notions. Would you like to speak a little bit about the work that you're doing at Unity House?
Okay. One of the organizations that got its beginning from, among other sources, from Shalom Ministries is a house of hospitality on the south side of Chicago. The south side of Chicago is one of the, geographically and in terms of population, one of the largest African American communities in the country, so far as we know. And although there's a tremendous range of economic status on the south side, there are large sections of it that are very poor. And Unity House started as a house of hospitality for people in one of these very poor neighborhoods on the south side. And initially they tried to provide whatever people came in wanting. So clothing, food, advocacy, referral sources, community development, a pretty wide range of services. Within the last couple years, the organization has managed to buy the building next door, which is an old four-story house, basically. At one point, this neighborhood was quite affluent. And we've renovated it, and it now houses seven mothers and children who otherwise would be homeless. The criterion for getting an apartment in the house is that you be 18 years old, be pregnant or have at least one small child, and have no place else to live. I'm on the board of this organization and I'm a psychologist, and of course you probably would not be surprised to hear that a number of these women and children have psychological difficulties. So within the last year, the board has asked me to provide counseling and therapy services for the women who requested in the house. I'm also involved in getting more volunteer help for the house and more money for the house. Running on a shoestring. So recently, I'm in my 100% time job. I teach graduate students in psychology. So we're working on organizing a cadre of volunteers among our clinical psych students to provide childcare and whatever enrichment services people in the house want and need. It's been very interesting to do this work and to think about this work, because it's a situation in which it would be quite easy to go in and say, well, I know what's needed here. You know? And I can do something for these people, right? The problem with that is that doing something for somebody is perilously close to doing something to somebody. It just really often turns out badly. And particularly when you're trying to do something for someone whose life has been very different from yours. So I see my task as, again, a kind of mission in reverse. As being there and being open enough to learn what these people have to teach me. And then when they ask for something, trying to provide it in a way that is cooperative and reciprocal and mutual. And I've been, I mean, sometimes this is a very frustrating kind of task, and it goes very slowly. But on the other hand, I've been astounded at how open the women have been and how many points there are where our lives touch. So I think that's enough said about, well, no, let me say one more thing. George talked about a session on tithing, about being deeply in relationship with someone else. I think in a lot of ways, a therapeutic relationship, when it really works, is a spiritual relationship. Because it requires that the therapist, quote-unquote, and the client, quote-unquote, really be open and be engaged in this reciprocal mutual dance. And that's when it works. So I find that my spiritual practice, when I take the time for it, which confession is not always, is really crucial to being able to do my job. Let me, without getting too long-winded, mention one other aspect of my life that I think ties in here. I teach in a graduate psychology program, and psychologists are kind of notoriously anti-religious, or at best, a-religious. Now, surveys of professional groups always come up with psychologists as having the lowest percentage of people who profess a religion and the highest percentage of people who profess to be atheists. And one of the very interesting things that's happened at my school is that in the 3 years that I've been there, we've started a program to provide a specialization in religion for our clinical psychology students. And so far as I know, we're the only non-sectarian institution where such a thing exists. There are a few psychology and religion programs, but they're all in Christian, in fact, conservative Christian institutions. The opportunity we have there is to explore religious issues in a multicultural, interfaith kind of context. I've had in my classes Buddhists, conservative Jews, conservative Christians, atheists, one sort of Sufi person, New Age folks, and to sit down with a group that's that diverse and to be respectful of one's own belief system and one's own practice and everyone else's, and to explore one's own beliefs and practices and everyone else's, is a very rich experience. And again, what my students tell me, for my class, I require that they engage in a spiritual practice within their own tradition. I can get away with that because the class is an elective. And what the students tell me is that the experience of engaging in practice, talking about it in a diverse community, and hearing about other people's experience of their practice, at the same time makes them more aware of their own faith and more secure in it, and less threatened by divergence of beliefs. And again, I think that is a spiritual experience. I mean, along the way, they're also learning psychological theory and technique. But I think the real transformative aspect of that is the spiritual experience of sharing in community in a way that celebrates diversity. So have I gone on long enough?
Well, I think, you know, I think what we're trying to describe is the fact that we're very busy people. We're stretched and pulled lots of different ways, as many of you are. And so part of what we've been trying to do is to evolve our prayer life in ways that we're not just overwhelmed by everyday life, and that we can be sustained in our faith journey and deep in our faith journey. And what we hope to offer you this week are some ways that we found helpful. They may or may not be helpful to you. We hope that they are helpful. But they're ways that have informed us both from our tradition, and also we've been attempting to bring into dialogue with our theology understandings from modern transpersonal psychology. There is an extensive dialogue going on between psychology and religion right now. Unfortunately, most of that dialogue is taking place between psychologists and Hindus and Buddhists, and there's only, and much less so between folks studying transpersonal psychology and Christians. And I'm very saddened by that. And I think there's some real historical reasons for that, but they're unfortunate. And so let me just say that part of what we're trying to do is to bring that kind of cultural understanding, you know, into our theological reflection, because modern psychology has some helpful things to offer, I think, religious people. And I think certainly, I think that Christianity has a lot to offer folks who are working in the caring professions as psychologists. Let me just mention at this point the two books that we asked the bookstore to order. One has come in, The Open Mind, Open Heart, which is we think a really excellent book about centering prayer, which is one of the three methods that we find helpful. The second book, Lost Christianity by Jacob Needleman, who's a comparative religions person and philosopher, is really an excellent book about the contemplative tradition written by a transpersonal psychologist. Unfortunately, that book is only in print now in England, and so they're only able to get a few copies of that. In addition, there's a wonderful book. One of the few really, really good things that we really like is brand new, called Belonging to the Universe. It's a conversation between Fritjof Capra, who's a new paradigm scientist, and David Stendahl Rast, who's a very articulate Catholic contemplative. So they're looking at new paradigms in theology and in science. Another book that the bookstore has, which I can recommend only limited way, there's a book called Tithing, The Art of Spiritual Presence. It's got some interesting stuff in it, but it also, I think, misses the mark. We'll talk some about that on Thursday. So I think the other part is I want to emphasize the practical. In other words, one of the things that's happened, particularly in the culture where I teach, in other words, I spend about approximately half my time working with the homeless, and I spend the other half of my time in Hyde Park in Chicago. For those of you who know, Hyde Park is one of the most rarefied academic atmospheres that you can find. And so it's kind of like to be whipsawed between, you know, there's real gritty stuff and, you know, stuff that is pretty much up in the air. And the general view in the seminaries about people who are contemplatives is, first of all, it doesn't have much relevance for Protestantism, you know, and secondly, that when I first came to Chicago, I was interviewing. I was interviewing at the Divinity School, and I was accepted in that program. And I talked with one of the folks there, and I said, I'm a contemplative, and I want to come to seminary to kind of be able to learn theology, to kind of figure out how to put words around this experience and to go deeper in ministry. And the response was, we don't have many contemplatives around here, folks. You know, this is not a place for contemplatives. And part of the rationale for it is that, you know, that the contemplative life is not relevant to the 20th century. I mean the kind of image that people have is of folks sitting in monasteries, and not, you know, and not being engaged in the world. And so much of our struggle has been to look back at many of the folks who've written, both the historical contemplatives and folks who are contemporaries, and to realize that, I mean, that is not a correct analysis. Certainly, there were and are monastic traditions where people were removed from all of their life, but there also have been throughout history contemplatives who come back into the world and been extremely effective. The methods in general are methods of renewal and a removal, and so part of what we're continuing to struggle with is to try to figure out ways of and methods that may be of help to those of us who lead busy lives. And so that's part of the practical aspect of what we're talking about. We'll be talking about methods this week, but I want to indicate that methods should not be separated from living in community and from living different ways. Oftentimes when people talk about methods of prayer, it's kind of technique-y. It's like, here's, you know, here's 14 things to do. And I think if we separate this out from a really integrated faith journey and a deepening kind of process in community, I think it's very dangerous. And I continue to stress the importance of community, because one of the things that happens as we open ourselves up is a lot of unconscious stuff comes up. I mean, as a psychologist, is that kind of word? I mean, a lot of stuff, a lot of our garbage comes up as we start opening ourselves up, because we're opening ourselves up to levels of ourself as well as to the presence of God. And so a lot of garbage can come up, and it's really important to have some other folks around to kind of be of help to kind of, you know, let us know, you know, what's, you know, what's what. And if we start having some, one of the things that oftentimes will happen will be when we start noticing what's going on internally, we realize we're not such great folks. That's one of the first things I noticed. I wasn't as good as I thought I was. So I realized a lot of the internal dialogue that's going on is basically a George pep talk. You know, it's like, yeah, George, you did a good job. That was good, George. Forget about the bad thing. That didn't count. The good thing was, you know, this kind of thing is going on all the time inside of our heads. And what it does, it keeps us from connecting with the world, because we're constantly kind of creating our own melodrama. And so it's very important to be in community. It's very important not to lose track of the tradition or the traditions that you're in. One of the tragic things, or many tragic things, one of the tragic things about much of the New Age work is that people don't have a tradition to link back to. So people who may be having this spiritual hunger and are looking oftentimes for a quick fix, is they're hooking up with people who don't have a history of, you know, tens or hundreds or even thousands of years to keep from getting lost. That's a lot of people do. So part of what we're suggesting is that the practices that we're talking about as methods really need to be integrated into a community of faith. In our case, it happens to be our church community, our seminary community, and then also the covenantal community we belong to. And so it's grounded in those ways, and those communities act as communities of accountability and support. Well, I think we've talked a lot, and I guess what I'm wondering is if you have any thoughts or comments at this point about what we've said thus far.
You know, a couple of times you both mentioned spiritual experiences, and maybe it would be helpful to us if you would talk for a minute about what do you mean by a spiritual experience? What's involved? How would we know if we had one? I think most people are kind of have an intuition.
That's one of the things you need your community for.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Let me preface this by saying that Andrew Greeley did a survey of a whole bunch of folks and asked the question, have you had a profound religious experience? He left it pretty vague, as I recall. Mm-hmm. About 40% of the people we surveyed said yes. We've had this kind of experience. I'll try to answer your question more directly. And one of the other things he asked, he says, who do you talk to about this? And most people said, we don't talk to anybody about it. Because in our culture, this isn't the usual way that we have conversations. You know, but guess who was really low on the list of who people were talking to?
Pastors.
Yeah, you got it. Pastors were about 10th on the list. Okay. And so one of the reasons that I'm teaching a class in seminary about called Practical Theology of Mysticism is to help pastors get a bit more grounding in the tradition of the contemplatives in our tradition. Religious experience.
Spiritual experience.
Okay, spiritual experience. We talked the other night about a certain kind of sweetness of being in a community and being about the reduction of suffering and the increasing of joy amongst oppressed people. And having that be something that was an outpouring of the heart rather than an agenda that was kind of ego-driven. I think one of the experiences I can say very concretely was a profound religious experience to me, an experience of giftedness, another thing I mentioned last week was encountering a guy who's homeless and worships with us sometimes at our church, who came up to me on the street one day and out of the blue said, Father George, he said, if you want to recycle aluminum cans, don't do it here, but go over five blocks over on the other side of the tracks because they give you a couple cents more a pound there. And that was the gift this guy had to offer me. There was a sense of profound openness and connectedness with another human being that went beyond the usual kind of boundaries. I think the nature of the path that we're describing, at least as we can put words, if I can best put words about it now, is a sense of opening. An opening to the presence of God, an opening to the other human being in ways where boundaries are very much eroded, where we really become one. I know that this happens oftentimes again, a lot of the message uses words of intimacy, these metaphors of love and compassion, because it's difficult to put words around, but it's a sense of deep, deep belonging and connectedness. One of the problems I have in this book on tithing is that they spend a lot of time here talking about things that I regard as being extrasensory perception and those kind of things. And what I know is that the gifts of the Spirit are all in the way that I try to think about them, and are gifts that help to move deeper into experiencing the presence of God in everyday life. And these things that may happen, I don't deny that they happen, because I've seen lots of mystery in my life, and I'm sure some of you have. I know there's a lot of mystery. Some of us have been parties to miraculous healing. There's great mystery out there, but I think it's maybe a mistake to focus on that, and that's a distraction maybe from going deeper in this process of being with God. Yes.
How does that differ, say, from the feeling that a community gets when Minnesota won the World Series, for example, which is a deep emotional bonding, going to people, for instance, who didn't care about baseball, and a lot of people found out about this and found out about others. Now, is that what you would call at that level, a spiritual experience?
That's more spiritual.
Well, I mean, it's obviously broader and deeper than what you were talking about. You know, your example, I think, was something along this line. There are many people who connected at a broader and deeper level because of this. Yeah.
Well, there's a sense of, there is a sense of human community that's very wonderful in something like that. Mm-hmm. I think issues of discernment have to do with, are you moving deeper on the spiritual path? Okay, and by deeper, again, I would use the notion of the imitation of Christ. Is my life exhibiting more signs of behaving more like Christ did when he was here with us?
Well, I think studies of the effect of a championship victory show that it does have that deeper effect. It makes people work harder, crimes reduced,
Not in Chicago. Not in Chicago. We had riots right after the Bulls victory. But I think the issue of discernment has to do with, I think, this going deeper, deeper in the journey and opening ourselves in these kinds of ways to becoming more in the imitation of Christ. And I think that would be my definition of how I would, in community, try to figure out whether or not I'm in the right path or not.
And so you think that these things, while they are deep and profound in many of their effects, have a base, whereas there are other things that are happening that open up something that does not close shut. That you can keep proceeding along that line, whereas the case I'm talking of, it seems to have a natural end.
Well, except for the diehard sports fans, I don't think there's a spiritual tradition that it falls back into for theological reflection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think that's another part of that. What I'm saying is that that's really critical.
Yeah, I think maybe the phenomenon you're talking about, and I think any phenomenon that makes people more open to each other, has sacred elements. Mm-hmm. Somehow partakes of the sacred. And it's like a lot in life. I mean, I think the sacred is all around us all the time. And the question is not discovering it or finding it or getting access to it, because I think we always have that. The question is how to be aware of it. How to put ourselves in the state of mind and heart so that we can recognize it.
As we live... as we grow to get deeper in our faith in that walk, then that broadening is almost like we're living more expectantly, and we expect God's presence in the spiritual happenings in our lives.
And in fact, to answer your question, which I don't know if I interpreted correctly, but I thought part of what you were asking is, what does it feel like? Or how do you know you have?
Well, I think any way you want to speak to it would be.
One of the things in my life that I identified as a spiritual experience was a feeling that I had at the end of a two-day silent retreat. When I went through a period of time when it was like I was on the edge of seeing something, of noticing something. And I found myself just kind of waiting and listening and looking. It's the way I had felt earlier that day when I'd been walking in the woods and come across a deer that I didn't expect. And it's like, But it wasn't that I was seeing something I didn't expect. It was that I knew it was potentially there. No, and it was a kind of quiet alertness.
Now, some...
Scott's been...
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to add a phrase that came to mind when we were talking. One of the things I wanted to pick up on what you said is that God can use any kind of experience to be the context of a spiritual experience, and not just really unusual experiences, as valuable as they might be, visions and unusual dreams and the glossolalia or whatever. For me, it's been those experiences that have substantially changed my conscious point of view. In a way that I think Jesus would approve. So we may glimpse a bit of the eternal Tao, as Buber said, in the hubbub of winning the World Series, and perhaps that does have some value, but I doubt if it changed people's conscious point of view for the long term about much. Maybe it could. As opposed to some other kinds of experiences we could all think of in our lives where we really were quite different afterwards. We never could go back after that. Life was different. Our viewpoint was different. I mean, we may slip back into things, but we were really quite different.
Well, I was going to say that one of the things that adult stage developmental psychology has to offer us as a possible way of looking at this process of deepening is some of Maslow's notions about fully actualized human beings. Some other people have run with that and extended the human developmental process into looking at what they call the transpersonal realm, which is going beyond the personal, which is beginning to have sensibilities and intuitions and openings of the heart to larger segments of humanity than self. And it gets a little strange here because part of this process of opening is both kind of a moving ahead in one way and a moving back in another. And a theorist named Ken Wilber's written a very wonderful book called No Boundary. Those of you who requested the list will indicate some of his work on that. But it's, he talked about the pre versus trans fallacy. I don't know if most of you realize this, but most traditional psychiatrists and psychologists regard most deep religious experience as being regression. It's kind of going back to, if you can't cope with reality, you get religion. I mean, that's basically the long and the short of it. And you go back to a younger developmental stage to be able to kind of mobilize your resources so you can then cope with the stressor and move ahead. And this business of becoming childlike, becoming like little children, not childish, but childlike. And Wilber talks about the pre versus trans fallacy. He says that some of these very profound experiences that folks have written about are transpersonal, that is, they're going beyond the usual adult fully functioning level into some other level of functioning that is even more developed than less developed. So it's a trans versus a pre kind of process. And I think that's some mapping that some of the Christian mystics have talked about. And Nancy and I have recently become very interested in some of the Eastern Orthodox Church work, which has attempted to develop some maps, again, to put containers, to use some Jungian lines, to put some containers around these experiences. Because I don't know if any of you who are pastoral counselors or pastors have had to deal with people who've had some of these openings, they can be very earth-shattering for folks. And trying to figure out how to be of help to those folks to help them move to the next stage is a very difficult and tricky process. Most psychologists are not equipped to be of help. Most psychiatrists are not equipped to be able to help. And so part of our interest is to be with people who are in psychology and psychiatry to see if we can figure out better ways of being of help to people who are very well-functioning human beings who are moving into these other kinds of experiences. So there's some other developmental pieces I think we wanted to throw out. Are there other questions that people might have? Does this make sense?
You really ought to then have a very acute picture of what the most fully developed human beings would be like. In other words, we're talking about value levels. Something is more valuable, more developed, more mature. and yet you're dealing with something where, in a sense, to be childlike is more valuable than to be an adult. To be giving, in a very simple sense, is more valuable than to be grasping. Mm-hmm. And yet, for most of our development, we learn just the opposite.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's this kind of paradox, huh?
Yeah.
The paradox is, after we get to a certain point, then we start undoing some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's one of the really interesting conversations that's going on now in psychology, because since Freud, until about the mid-70s or early 80s, the model for mature human development was independence and autonomy. Freud said that a healthy person was able to love and to work, but his emphasis was really on work, And now the object relations psychologists and the self psychologists are beginning, although they still don't say the S word, spirituality, or the R word, religion, are beginning to think about mature interrelationship, mm-hmm. mature needs, mature dependence. And that's much closer, I think. It's getting psychology closer to being able to take the next step beyond mature human self-development to mature human religious development.
But then you must have some idea, for instance, we could classify people whom we've studied at great length mm-hmm. as to how developed they were.
Yeah, and Wilbur and his colleagues and some other folks are beginning to do that work.
Mm-hmm. And again, unfortunately, most of the work, and unfortunately, I think for the richness of the dialogue along many dimensions, most of that work is being done with the East, because there's mm-hmm. so few contemporary folks who are contemplatives. But let me also just follow up and say, with regard to the fact, if we're looking for models, again, I mean, there's the model of Christ, but also the model of the saints. I mean, I've been reading a wonderful book on Francis and on St. Francis. And so, I mean, I think that's what, I mean, I
think. Which you found in the Holden Library.
The Holden Library, a wonderful book, that's right. And I think we have some models in our tradition, but it's the last five, six, seven centuries where theology and contemplation have diverged that make it much more difficult for us to recover these things, so now we're trying. Folks like us are kind of stumbling through the woods, trying to figure out how to authentically be within our tradition and how to find methods that are going to work for us in our contemporary life. So there are models out there, and again, as far as we know thus far, the system that looks like it's the most complete. And I know some of you have studied this. In these matters too, maybe in the system, but so far it looks like the models that look the most complete come from the Eastern Orthodox tradition, or the map of that other earth.
I know.
Why do you say that?
No, but
why do you say that the Eastern Orthodox tradition is where you have to find your models? I mean, there's a tremendous.
Well, I didn't say that. Okay, I don't really have to find the models. So they're most explicit.
In the pre-Reformation Church, I mean, there was a tremendous Western Church, a tremendous tradition. It was a lot of it centered around the monastic tradition, but then so it hasn't done in Eastern Orthodoxy. I mean, it's there. Speculative mysticism is what you're calling experiential development. First time you get it. I mean, it's there. Do we really need to reinvent the wheel?
Well, are we doing it?
You have told me what you've been actually doing in concrete terms, yeah.
Yeah.
But
who would you look to? I mean, I'm interested. Believe me, I'm saying we're seekers. So, I mean, I know. I mean, yeah.
Well, they're the German mystics. Eckhart, Tolle, Husserl, all those, and might improve Luther in there in a way. Certainly had the grounding there and the interest. There's the other whole mystic wing of the Teresa's and like that, which I don't think would perhaps transfer so terribly well, at least not without a lot of transmogrification. Mm-hmm. To Protestants, the German mystics would seem to be the obvious place to look. You've got the Ignatian model. Mm-hmm. There's lots of it there.
Sure. And again, the thing that struck us, and maybe we could talk in more detail as we go along during the week about this, it's the maps and stages of development that seem to be brought down to the present day in the Eastern Orthodox Church that we're finding interesting. Mm-hmm. And again, it's this idea of putting a container around and looking at what happens step by step. But I certainly celebrate with you, you know, certainly the German mystics, and I'd be interested to see as we talk about how that might be translated into kind of, you know, being about these kind of practices today.
Part of it, I think, is those Luther's enormous emphasis on baptism, that basic Lutheran idea is that once you're baptized, that's it. You don't get any higher. Mm-hmm. Ordination, marriage, nothing that the church can do, nothing that you can do can ever make you more than one of God's children. And so to talk about levels of development for Christians is a very odd sort of thing. You know, that's to say, you're a better Christian than I am. You're a class two and I'm a class one. And whenever that comes up, the church reacts very strongly against that and say, that's sheer nonsense. I mean, it may be that you're more effective as a preacher than I am, but to say you're a better Christian is a very odd way to put it.
Well, I think part of the difficulty there is that when we think developmental model, we think the top of it is better than the bottom of it, or the end of it is better than the beginning of it. And that doesn't really make sense to me in the context of religious experience or mystical experience or spiritual experience. I think it's not, the issue is not who's better than whom, but how can we experience the fullness of God or come closer and closer to it? And I don't think we ever do experience the fullness of God. But for our own spiritual health and growth, how can we make ourselves increasingly ready, increasingly aware?
It's paradoxical, you see, because, again, most of this means kind of undoing kind of our adult kind of stuckness.
Our adult autonomy.
And hierarchy, in this sense, again, we're coming to understand as the models are kind of the ideas of logical embeddedness rather than greater than, less than. And so I agree. I think, and the way that Keating talks about it, I think he's a much better theologian than I am, we're just looking at ways to kind of predispose ourselves for the Spirit to move. And it's not a matter, it's a matter of just using what's within the tradition that may, you know, make that a little bit easier for some one person rather than another. So I agree. I think it's very dicey to look at things in terms of development, I mean, in a standard developmental approach. I'm fully in agreement with you. But what I also know is that the way human beings function is extraordinarily difficult for us to open our hearts to one another. It's extraordinarily difficult to do that. And so as a practical person, I'm very much interested in finding out whatever I can about how to encourage myself, to open myself, and to have other people open themselves to one another. And I think that's where I think some of these folks have some things to offer us. But I agree, I think that notion of better than worse, I mean, that's caused undue pain and I think it's what it's meant is a lot of folks who've had everyday lives have felt that they are lesser people because they aren't like the folks mm-hmm. in the monasteries. And that's a dreadful tragedy. Yes.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reaction against monasticism and the feeling that spiritual exercises were a different kind of works righteousness theologically. And but I think that the swing was to, by damning them as a type of spiritual works righteousness, they are turned into something that is even less important than ordinary works. I mean, works had their place, even in Luther's theology, as an outpouring of God's justifying grace. Spiritual works likewise ought to be in the same, at least treated no more poorly than concrete